from the National Humanities Center. This is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. Women's education in modern India and the colonial city in the Third World, this week on Soundings. My guests are Gail Minot of the University of Texas at Austin and David Prohaska of the University of Illinois. First on this edition of Soundings, a conversation with Gail Minot about her new study of social change and women's education in modern Indian society. Following that, a discussion with David Prohaska about his book on the colonial city in the Third World. Here is Gail Minot.
The players in this interaction are the British imperialists, the British administrators, who are gradually taking over rule in India in the 19th century and who are firmly in place, the Raj in the 20th century. And the opposing team, if you will, is the Indian elites who are in touch with the British.
Mm-hmm.
Because we're not talking here about the populace so much. I mean, this is a study of cultural interaction, and to have cultural interaction, you have to have people who have ideas, who write those ideas down. And so I'm studying an elite, and that is perhaps very traditional in historical study.
Are we back to the Jewel and the Crown, E.M. Forster,
well,
that kind of stuff? What?
No, because what I'm really concerned with is debate within the Indian elite over the desirability of change and how change takes place. Does it take place by adopting British ideas and institutions? Does it take place by hanging on to tradition, that is, rejecting outside influence, which is not necessarily rejecting change, but creating change out of your own culture? Is it some combination of the two, which is what I'm really interested in, the kind of ambivalence here between admiring some of the things that the British have to offer, but at the same time not wanting to take it on wholesale.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that a great many of the Indian urban elites adopted was education, in English education. And they were often very favorable towards that, but they were not favorable, for example, to British religion, proselytization.
Mm-hmm.
They drew the line at that.
Gail Minot, how is it that the issue of women's education serves, this is kind of a vehicle for you as you look at social change in 19th and 20th century India. Why does that crystallize, the study that you're after here?
Well, of course, I mentioned before that the Indian elites, the men, adopted Western education with a fair degree of alacrity. And as time went by, they also thought that it might be nice to have educated wives for themselves or their sons.
This was an afterthought kind of thing?
Well, it developed, I think, gradually, again, as a sort of, as change, economic, political, and so on, was taking place, the elites felt a certain strain in their lives, a certain lack of communication, if you will, between themselves and the women in their lives.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was a fair amount of writing about the need for women's education. Not that women should be English educated, that they should become like English women, heaven forfend, but that they should be well educated in the vernacular, they should be literate, they should be able to manage the household, they should be better mothers to their children, better companions to their husbands, really very much a sort of 19th century domesticity a view of women's education.
What indeed happened?
What
encouragement,
happens?
Discouragement, what?
What happens, of course, is that the first generation of women to become educated then pass on ideas of education to their daughters, ideas of greater independence. The daughters then do go out and start working. They do get involved in the national movement. They do espouse their own causes in ways that their fathers probably viewed with horror, although some of them were very supportive. I mean, look at someone like, Madame Pundit, for example, who's the sister of Jawaharlal Nehru, the aunt of Indira Gandhi. She was the daughter of an educated lawyer, and she got an education. And she then became active in the national movement and was jailed, as was her brother. These were Kashmiri Brahmins of a very traditional educated group in society who had served the Mughals before they served the British and so on and so forth, who then became nationalists. And the women became politically and socially active. These were not things that the first generation of men who were espousing women's education had thought of.
They didn't really anticipate the consequences of all of this.
It was all right for women to get educated in order to be better wives and mothers,
But
they didn't really want them to start carrying signs.
Well, that in effect, that's what happened. I mean, we look at Indian political history, and we've had Indira Gandhi as the prime minister of in Indian society. Well, is that a sort of a natural outgrowth of all of these issues that you are, these threads that you're teasing out here, women's education in India? Was that completely unexpected?
Well, a natural outgrowth might be too strong, but Indira Gandhi then is the daughter of Jawaharlal Nehru. She was active in the nationalist movement. She too was jailed. She too grew up in that generation or that period when women who had become educated said enough of this British rule. In a way, were very Westernized. But they turned that Western education and that Western thought, that Western secular political thinking, to nationalist accounts.
Mm-hmm. How does all of this play itself out, as we look at Indian society in the 1980s, Gail Minot? Do you measure it in terms of the contemporary effects? I'm asking you both about the substance as well as the methodology of this project that you've embarked on. How do you figure out how women's education influences Indian society today, for example?
Well, I think that in terms of an overall methodology, we have to realize the ambivalences, that you don't simply take an institution or a set of ideas and transplant them from one culture to another.
Mm-hmm.
That if you do so, and people are constantly doing that, you run some risk, but also what happens is that the ground that you plant the idea or the institution in influences the way it comes out.
Uh-huh.
Or to use rather than an agricultural example, to use a more technological example, it's easier to buy the hardware than to adapt the software.
This reminds me of Norman Mailer's argument about communism and Vietnam. He said, in the Armies of the Night, we are overlooking the enormous influence of Vietnamese culture apart from these sort of exterior political forces. And I recall also the comment of one of your colleagues here at the Humanities Center, Paul Courtright, who said that as India becomes more modern, it becomes more traditional. It sounds like that's what you are after. Have I got that right?
Yes. What we want to be constantly aware of is the constant interplay between what comes in from the outside and what's there already.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a process which is ongoing, which began a long time ago, obviously. And so that the even what is Indian today is a combination of Western and Indian and, you know, heaven knows what.
Mm-hmm.
A very complex mixture.
Gail Minot, let's wrap up our conversation. You're looking at social change in 19th and 20th century India. Do American women in the 1980s have anything to learn from Indian women over the last 100, 150 years?
The discriminatory patterns in our own society are much more subtle. In India, they're much more overt.
What, more ceremonial and all of that?
I don't know. In Indian society, it's quite clear that women still have a very rough time of it. Women have had a very important sort of behind-the-scenes role, and that this importance of the family, this importance of solidarity among women, I think has a fair amount to teach women in our society, where families are very much more atomized, where women are viewed much more as individuals, and where sisterhood and solidarity among women to organize, to change things is hard to come by. In India, they still have that traditional solidarity or sisterhood, at least in some contexts, and this makes organization for some sort of public cause, whether it's nationalism, of course, the nationalist legacy is very important here, or whether it's agitation against bride burning or something. The women have a kind of traditional solidarity, which, again, the relationship of tradition and change, which enables them to organize for changing society. It may be easier for them to do that than for us. So that may be something that we can learn from them.
Gail Minot teaches at the University of Texas at Austin. During a recent fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, Gail Minot worked on a study of women's education and social change in modern Indian society. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Soundings continues now. My guest is another scholar who recently completed a fellowship year at the center. David Prohaska teaches at the University of Illinois. He's at work on a study entitled The Colonial City in the Third World. Here is David Prohaska.
To exemplify my approach, let me read the following. Take a walk in Delhi. The commercial heart of New Delhi is Connaught Circus, patterned after its London namesake, a huge circle of buildings two stories and higher with arcaded walkways and large high-ceiling stores often situated on the second floor. This is where you go if you want foreign imported goods, from fancy ice cream parlors and European-style grocery stores to the choicest white peaches from Kashmir sold by kids in ratty clothes on the street. Several miles away, in the heart of Old Delhi, is Chandni Chowk, Hindi for Silver Street. Chandni Chowk is a bazaar, an Indian souk, a long, narrow street teeming with people, consisting of shop after shop, the majority of which sell silver. It is what the travel guides call picturesque, animated, the hot, humid air thick with incense, the garishly lit shops almost indistinguishable one from the other. What it is, and I'm trying to come to terms with my own experience in the Third World, which goes back now to having spent more than 5 years in the last 10 years of my life in various continents and various cities in the Third World. And part of this project is an attempt to pull some of those impressions and some of the book knowledge that I've gathered along the way together. What struck me, however, was the degree to which no one has really attempted to pull together what people have said about different cities in different continents different places in the Third World together, nor have they really kind of spun out in any sort of detail what it is that these cities may, or for that matter, may not have in common.
Well, now, I get the impression that if we went to the encyclopedia or to a book of statistics,
you
we could
find it.
Well, we could find lots of things about population, and we could find things about water and public health and things like that. But that really isn't what you're after. Let's go back to that word, personal impressions.
Well, having lived in the Third World and in a variety of especially post-colonial cities in the Third World, what struck me was that in looking at the literature that's grown up, in the social scientific literature in particular, we have a very large gap between cities in the industrial world that are basically described in modern, contemporaneous terms on the one hand, and on the other hand, cities that we label in one form or another traditional, pre-modern, or the like. One of my impressions, memories of Delhi, for example, is walking and confronting an enormous billboard which advertised in Hindi. It was a billboard, an advertisement for family planning, in fact. Limit your family to 2 or 3 children, that's all. Directly underneath the billboard sat an old Hindu gentleman in traditional Hindu dress with a sewing machine. This kind of juxtaposition is exactly what I'm trying to unpack, what I'm trying to unravel in the study that I'm doing.
This reminds me of the photographs of Walker Evans. What do we have? Migrant workers and poor people in the 30s and 40s in the United States in front of billboards for brand new cars. Are we talking about an economic issue here? Is that one of the fundamental threads that you're teasing out?
Certainly. One of the major aspects is the incredible poverty throughout these sorts of cities in the Third World. This is unquestionably one of the things that has struck me, in fact, between, on the one hand, how do you communicate this? How do you convey this? When you go all too often to the scholarly or the historiographical literature, you read dry sociological or political scientific studies of poverty in the abstract. For example, I'm very struck by the enormous disparities in residential segregation throughout these sorts of cities, which are utterly striking and for which you can make a crystal clear argument. That is certainly grist for my historical mill.
All right, now the argument being what? That this is a bad thing? I take it that you would judge this, in fact, to be a bad thing, that there are large neighborhoods, populations of people who are segregated by race or class. Is that what you're after?
It's not simply that they're bad and to make that sort of evaluation, but is to use that study of, for example, residential segregation to illuminate the larger issues of how it was people in the colonial city managed to live side by side, separately but apart from one another. For example, when we're talking about residential segregation in a colonial city, we are talking typically about a colonized population being segregated from a colonizer population. And I want to use the study of segregation to get at the larger issues of what that sort of segregation means for individuals.
What does it mean for individuals? What's the import?
Well, if we think today in terms of, for example, what is going on in South Africa, elsewhere in the African continent, where these patterns of segregation continue to be produced and reproduced, then I think that this sort of study is going to shed light on the nature not only of the post-colonial city, that is the post-independent city, but as well the colonial city, which after all gave birth to the cities we see and visit today.
Mm-hmm. One of the ironies, I think, that's inherent in what you're looking at here, David Prohaska, is the notion that some of these cities, many of them, are glamorous. They represent the bizarre, the exotic, the different. When we compare them to, you know, life as we know it in, you know, middle America, wherever we happen to earn our bread. Are you criticizing that? Are you qualifying it? What is it that we should understand about these larger images of the colonial city in the Third World? I'm thinking, for example, of Cusco in Peru. Why would you pick that?
What I want to begin with is 16th century Cusco. And I want to start by talking about the conquest, the Spanish conquest, and specifically the effects it had on the transformation, on the way in which that city was literally turned topsy-turvy. The Spaniards, of course, built their city, the new city of Cusco, directly on top of the Incaic stone ruins. But instead of going to the enormous and, if not impossible, labor of actually physically removing these gigantic blocks of stone, when it came time to rebuild and reconstruct, they literally used the Incaic foundations as their foundations, on top of which they built their city. Now, what's interesting here to me in particular is not simply this physical building on top of one another, but that the way in which the Spanish were enormously intelligent and acute about the symbolic nature of where and how they laid out the city, where they sited the main cathedral, and all the rest of it. That is to say, Spanish Cusco was meant literally to be an inversion in the built environment of Incaic Cusco.
It sounds to me like there's a debt of gratitude here that needs to be repaid. It sounds to me as though we have a perception of the colonial city in the Third World as we know it that has an antecedent that we have not yet fully acknowledged.
Absolutely.
Let's move to the 19th century in Delhi. What are you after there?
In Delhi, the history of the Brits in Delhi can be broken down into a series of periods. What especially interests me is Delhi is the capital of the chief British colony. Mm-hmm. At the very beginning of the 20th century, it was deemed of such importance that it was going to be built and completely laid out so that architects were hired to create a new Delhi. There are as many different Delhis on the various sites of these cities as there are Rome's. New Delhi today is located several miles away from what, of course, is termed Old Delhi. What the Brits did at the beginning of the 20th century was to move outside the city at that time into vacant land and to lay out on a grandiose, truly imperial scale, their imperial capital.
Let me be a little contentious with you, David Prochaska. What's the difference between this model that you're describing of the colonial city in the Third World and what actually happened here on American shores with the construction is too deliberate a kind of term, the growth, the development of New York City, which is nothing but a bunch of neighborhoods composed of all these different ethnicities. Are we talking about some grand design that is missing or present in this configuration?
That's a good point. There certainly are parallels to the development of cities in the U.S. that inhabit what I would place them at one end of the spectrum of colonial cities. Mm-hmm. In the case of the Eastern Seaboard, by and large, the Native American population was physically removed before the New Yorks and the other cities were built.
So they were out of the picture and they weren't underneath. They didn't serve as the groundwork necessarily the way you have in Cusco and Delhi.
That's right.
What about your 20th century example, David?
The 20th century example is the capital of Ivory Coast, Abidjan. And what strikes me here is that here we do have an utterly contemporaneous city. This is one of the few cities in the Third World that I've seen with what could be mistaken for a, quote, Western, unquote, skyline.
And yet that's deceptive. Am I reading right between the
absolutely.
Lines?
Absolutely. There's an enormous hotel, the Hotel Ivoire, that was built. That is the main hotel in town, and each Sunday afternoon, various groups of Ivorians are trucked and bused into town and invited to put on folkloric skits in the square in front of the hotel for the bemusement of both their fellow Ivorians as well as the numerous tourists that are staying at the Hotel Ivoire.
This reminds me of an experience I had in South America when I was in Paraguay. A group of American tourists were taken out somewhere onto an island in the middle of the Guadani River, and a bunch of Indians came out, saw the tourists coming, got undressed, the chief of the Indian tribe put a great big boa constrictor around his neck, and they all stood around and asked for money while they posed for pictures. When the tourists left, they all got dressed and went back to work.
Marvelous. Uh-huh. Marvelous. That sort of story is exactly what it is that I'm trying to get a handle on. We need to begin to recognize the stereotypes that we apply to these places for the stereotypes that they are.
They're bad things.
Secondly, we need to begin to look at and take these cities and these peoples that inhabit these cities at face value for what they are and in their own terms.
David Prohaska is a professor at the University of Illinois. During a recent fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, David Prohaska worked on a study entitled The Colonial City in the Third World. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Soundings is available on cassette. Ask for program number 421. The address is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. When writing, please mention the call letters of this radio station. Next week on Soundings, conversations about religion and theology in early Christianity and in the modern world. My guest will be Jill Rate of the University of Missouri at Columbia and Jeffrey Sangkwah of the University of Oxford. Here's news of interest to high school teachers. In June and July of 1989, the National Humanities Center will sponsor seminars on two topics, literature and its publics, and the concept of republicanism. These enrichment programs are for high school teachers of literature and history. For an application, write to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. The deadline for applications is March 1st, 1989. Soundings concludes now with Timeline, a weekly cultural retrospective. The fourth week in October marks birthday anniversaries for Gertrude Ederle, the first woman to swim the English Channel. Ederle was born in 1906. For Pablo Picasso, the Spanish painter, sculptor, and engraver, Picasso was born in 1881. For James Boswell, the Scottish biographer, who was born in 1740. And for Dylan Thomas, the Welsh poet and playwright, who was born in 1914. The last week in October marks the anniversary of the death of Geoffrey Chaucer, the author of the Canterbury Tales. Chaucer died in London in the year 1400. The Federalist Papers first appeared in a New York City newspaper at the end of October 1787. The Federalist Papers presented arguments for the adoption of the American Constitution and the formation of the federal government. Finally, the last week in October is the anniversary of the founding of Harvard University, which was established by the Massachusetts General Court at Cambridge at the end of October 1636. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Support for Soundings comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Women's Education in Modern India and the Colonial City in the Third World, next on Soundings. Listen for Gail Minot of the University of Texas at Austin, at work on a new study of social change and women's education in modern India, and for David Prohaska of the University of Illinois, writing a book about the colonial city in the Third World. Third World Cultures, some answers and insights, this week on Soundings.